Welcome to Saga Thing, where we're putting the sagas of the Icelanders on trial. I'm John.
And I'm Andy. And this is our fourth episode on Svarfdala Saga, the saga of the tumultuous valley.
How are you feeling about this?
Well, I mean, we kind of ended the last episode by deciding that we need to start fresh after the hole in the middle of Svarfdala Saga. So here we are.
So what are we doing? We're doing regnal dating for the Stuart dynasty at this point, right? The fourth and first episode of the saga.
Oh, good. Yeah. Make things more confusing for everyone. Yeah. But you know, how are you feeling about this?
About what? About the saga? It's great. New challenges and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little worried the entire Lacuna episode we did last time may have just made things worse for, I mean, for the people who were trying to help make sense out of the story.
Yeah, I don't think so, but it's too late to second guess that now.
I know, but regret that I can do something about doesn't count as regret.
That's almost deep. I don't understand it, but it's probably deep.
So what do you think? Just do a quick review of the story and dive in?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, we spent a whole episode setting this thing up and talking about a piece of the saga that doesn't actually exist. So, I mean, even more than usual, we need a reminder about how we got here.
Agreed. So let's talk about what happened the time before last time on Saga Thing. Last time on Saga Thing! Dateline, the North Sea. We find Thorsten Thognesen, a gold-biter-turned-Viking warrior, still mourning the loss of his protective brother Thorolf in a costly battle against the late Lot the Pale. Thorsten and his surviving men sail to Sweden, where they introduce themselves to Earl Harald of Gotland, and then borrow his hall to throw an old-fashioned funeral shindig for Thorolf.
Earl Haroth likes the cut of Thorstein's Norwegian jib, and the two become fast friends. And Thorstein's well-cut jib also catches the attention of Haroth's daughter, Ingibjörg, who thinks he's just the ace for her Swedish base. But don't go ringing any wedding bells just yet. It seems there's trouble brewing, for Ingibjörg has also caught the eye of a local berserk named Moldy.
Moldy's the marrying kind, and like a basketball arena full of Bulls fans, he's got Harald's entire court cowed. And though he's oddly well-mannered for a shield-biting maniac, Moldy's not the man to stand politely by to make room for a rival.
He's more the over-my-dead-body type.
Indeed he is. And that ultimatum is music to Thorsten's ears. So he and Moldy agree to a good old-fashioned holmgang, so that one of them can provide the convenient dead body for the other to step over. But when Thorsten whips out the sword stolen from the corpse of Lot the Pale, it's Moldy whose face goes white, for the late Lot was none other than Moldy's beloved brother.
The fur begins to fly, but the fracas is lost to view, as our story stumbles over a gap in the manuscript. It won't be the last.
No, it will not.
When the saga continues, Moldy's body lies a-mouldering in the grave. And it's not long before Ingibjörg and Thorstein are, in fact, married over his dead body. But shortly after the birth of their first son, the manuscript suffers a second, more grievous wound. And the entire narrative spirals into darkness. What will we find when the lights go back on? Whose story is this now? Find out as we return to Svarfdala Saga, chapters 10 to 14a.
Only about four chapters again. It's ridiculous.
Well, it's better than the zero we did last time.
That's very true.
Actually, we were doing negative chapters last time.
That's a good point.
But if you are following along in the Icelandic edition that's not the Fornrit, then you're probably reading a version that might include some or all of the Rasmus Rask pages that fill in the gap left by the lacuna. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then we're starting around chapter 13 or so.
Right, but we're going to be dictated to by the version translated by Frederick Heinemann for the Complete Sagas of Icelanders edition, the Erikson Publishing edition, right? The mm-hmm. one that we've been using all along.
Yeah.
And Heinemann doesn't switch chapters at the lacuna.
Right. So even if we are jumping well ahead in the story, we're technically still in chapter 10 in our edition.
Yeah, chapter 10b, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. Now, hey, speaking of Rasmus Rask, John.
Oh, boy.
In our previous episode, I put out a call for some help from our listeners to maybe help us better understand the story of how Rask found those lost pages of Svarfdala Saga to fill in the big lacuna. And specifically, I called on Kauri Tolinius, who often comes to our aid with a bit of insider info.
You can always count on Kauri.
Indeed. Yeah, and if Kauri doesn't start branding Count on Kauri, I'm going to be upset. That's great stuff.
Well, what's Count on Kauri have to say about all this?
Well, he contacted us on Blue Sky, where he is K-A-T Tullus with two L's.
Catullus? Like the poet? Like the Roman poet?
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Only with a K and two T's and two L's, so not exactly. It's Catullus.
It's not confusing at all.
No. Anyway, he contacted us on Blue Sky to say, and this is what he wrote, it is unlikely that Rask is responsible for the content of Rask 37. He acquires it alongside Rask 36 and another unknown manuscript from its writer Olavur Sigurdsson, who would be a good candidate for out-of-the-box thinking. As Arman Jakobsen discusses in his book on Thouter, Olafur is probably the first person to think of Thouter as independent stories separate from their inclusion in the Konungasagar. He was 19 or 21 when he wrote Rask's 36 and 37, so it's easy to imagine some exuberant invention on his part.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Count on Kauri.
Yeah, so in this case, Rask is more of a collector and compiler of manuscripts, and Olafur Sigurdsson is the scribe who composed and maybe got creative with some of the manuscripts Rask bought.
That's correct, yes.
I see.
Now, of course, none of this helps us to confirm or to negate the authenticity of the Svartdala section of Rask 37. It does, however, suggest that we might be right to suspect that authenticity.
All right. Well, I hope you've all enjoyed another brief foray into manuscript studies. But we do have to talk about the actual saga at some point.
I like how you snuck that in. One more time.
You know.
Yes, and while it doesn't feel like we're making much progress with this saga, we will at least get to the halfway point by the end of this episode. So there.
Very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And like we mentioned in the Big Lacuna episode, we're heading into a very different kind of saga now.
As if the authors of the two different versions had two separate visions for what the story should be.
Yeah. Ultimately, though, the saga is still telling one story, just different versions of that story.
Sure, sure. So we have to make one major decision in transitioning past the Lacuna now. But after that, the narrative is still a saga version of a settlement story recounted in multiple texts. But I have to ask, John, do we consider this one saga or two separate sagas?
Yeah. So the one we have, the one we're reading, for our purposes, that's the story. David Benson, one of our professors at UConn, used to talk about the difference between the ways we academics tend to approach a text versus the way a medieval reader would have read it. Academics tend to want the best version of a text, the cleanest version, the clearest version, the most narratively coherent vision of the story. So we'll look for different variants. We'll sort out manuscript stemma and history. We'll use one manuscript to fill in gaps in another, all in pursuit of this imaginary perfect text. But a medieval reader, more likely than not, read the manuscript they had access to, made of it what sense it made, and that was it. That was the text. The closer we get to creating a perfect text, the farther we probably are from the reader's perspective in medieval literature.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I mean, it reminds me of the conversations I've had with students in literary theory courses, especially when we're exploring things like Foucault's What is an Author or Roland Barthes' Death of the Author. Both of those explore the concept of authors and ask the kinds of questions that literary scholars can dig into and get really excited about.
Right. It's the kind of questions that most students, even most English majors, don't seem to get as excited about as we do.
Yeah, that's an understatement. But we're privileged in medieval studies that we often don't have an author to overburden our approach to the text. So instead of things like what is an author, we have to ask what is a text? And I think that's a worthy question because it forces us to contend with some very fundamental questions about how we want to approach interpretation.
Right. No, it is a real advantage to us that we are rarely in danger of an author that we're discussing at a conference showing up at the back of the room and complaining.
Yes, exactly.
Now, I'm going to throw back the question you asked me. Is this one saga or two?
Well, it's a text, John, and that's all we need it to be.
Well said. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what do you think? You ready for Svartdala Saga, the reboot?
Let's go!
Part 7. Where are we? What's going on? Who are these people? All right, we really are at square one here. If you're listening to this and you've got some paper handy, you might want to write down a few names because these are all, or at least almost all, new people.
Yeah, so last time we read the first lines from where the narrative picks up. Do you want to do that again?
Nah, I think we can paraphrase.
Okay, so go back and listen if you don't remember.
Yeah, do that. There's been a big battle with 17 men killed. We're picking up the story right after that battle has ended, and the survivors on both sides are being named in the aftermath. Mm-hmm. One side are the supporters of a man named Jotolf, while the others follow Thorsten Tumultuous and his son, Karl the Red.
Great name.
It's a Tumultuous? Yeah, it's a great name.
Both of them, but yeah,
yeah. Tumultuous. We'll have to talk about whether it's an accurate name when we get to the nicknames and judgments, because some sources have a completely different name for this guy.
Yeah, well, like we said before, this might be a pastiche of different versions of the Thorstein Svarfather that was mentioned in mm-hmm. Landnamabok.
True enough, but who is he right now?
Well, he's Thorstein the Tumultuous.
Sure, why not? I mean, the valley, Svarfaðardalur, is definitely called Tumultuous, so mm-hmm. we can take a cue from that.
Absolutely. So Thorstein the Tumultuous and his son, Karl the Red, come out on top of this ambush that was sent by their rival, Jotolf.
And Thorsten, let's remember, is probably from the family of Thorsten the First from the previous episodes. Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly how, because when we left the earlier Thorsten, he and Ingebjörg had just had a baby boy named Thorolf.
Or, and this is an important or, it's the same Thorstein from the first part of the saga.
Right, and we don't need to rehash those arguments entirely. But the conclusion we came to is that this Thorsten is probably connected to the earlier one. But whether that's a familial link or the same guy but from a different version of the saga's reality, we just can't say. Mm-hmm. We ultimately have to treat this guy as a separate entity.
Yeah, if only so that we don't drive ourselves nuts.
I mean, that's always a laudable goal, isn't it?
Yeah. Although we did just talk about the saga as text. Isn't a Thorstein just a Thorstein, John?
If a Thorstein falls in the woods. I mean, ultimately, yes. We're merely dealing with him as a Thorstein. Right? I think
that
trying to resolve conclusively this question of his relationship to the original Thorstein misses the only way we can read this sort of usefully, which is to pick up the story as it stands and understand it on its own merits.
Yeah. So anyway, this particular Thorstein that we are encountering now has a name for attracting trouble, and he's living in Iceland. Did we mention that we're in Iceland now? Because here we are.
I think we did, but if not, we're in Iceland now.
Yeah, and he and Karl the Red, his son, have just finished this major battle for local control over a valley full of good farmland. Mm-hmm. It's probably a fantastic battle and the culmination of a long and masterful piece of suspense buildup by the narrative. You'll have to see Rask's manuscript for that, but... Mm-hmm. It's not here, so we're going to ask you to use your imagination.
Right. All right. And after this battle that was definitely epic, Thorsten and Karl are now the dominant force in this area of Iceland. And they have a crowd of supporters, but we don't need all those names right away. We'll save them. Right now, Thorsten needs to celebrate his victory, and he's an old-fashioned sort of guy when it comes to celebrating. So, obviously, as one does, he breaks a comb and starts burying silver marks around the area. As one does.
Well, I mean, it was the style at the time.
Yep. The saga tells us that this strip of land was named Comb after this. And this is like the answer to a trivia question, right? What's the laziest piece of onomastic writing ever in a saga? Eddie, this is so arbitrary that I wasted a fair amount of time trying to find the significance to it.
I'm not going to lie. I did too. A lot. Because it's such an interesting thing, because we did just finish Laxdalur Saga, mm-hmm. and we have another like origin Calmness, name. Yep. So I thought, surely there must be mm-hmm. some kind of tradition that we're just not aware of. But you might be onto something.
Right. Like a tradition of breaking a comb to mark territory.
Yeah.
I mean, the likely explanation, honestly, is that the word kombr in Old Norse has a similar set of meanings as the word comb in Old and Middle English. In English, a comb can mean thing you brush food out of your beard with, but it can also mean a ridge, right? Like the comb of a rooster. but also...
I like that your first idea of a comb is something that you brush food out of your beard with, hey, and not Andy, something you put in your hair.
You've got your priorities, I've got mine. I've got less and less hair on top of my head and more on my chin. So I know what I use my comb for.
Very interesting choice. All right, continue. Sorry.
But it's so because it's also a ridge or an edge of a valley, it's a super common element in place names, which anyone listening to this in the British Isles already knows. There are more than 240 places in the British Isles named for combs. So the most likely onomastic reason for this moment is to explain the extant name Comber for this spot. But I want to know if there was some deeper meaning here.
Mm-hmm. There isn't, though.
No, there isn't. There isn't. I didn't find any. It is true that combs are frequently found in pieces, but that's true of a lot of different types of objects.
Yeah,
and combs are everyday items. It's all out of wear and tear.
He went around breaking pots.
Right, right. I mean, I did read a really interesting paper by Heidi Luke on the repair and repurposing of broken combs.
Oh, cool.
Which was really interesting. But nothing about land claims or rituals. But if someone knows of a land claiming ritual involving breaking a comb, do let us know.
Given that I spent plenty of time looking as well, I would like to know. So now Thorstein claims the area by breaking the comb and spreading his silver around. And he names the valley Svarfadal, the tumultuous valley, after himself, wherever he got that nickname from.
Right, which might suggest he's already well known in Iceland by that name, or at least that he's identifying himself by that name in general.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we should be calling him Thorstein Combcracker.
Ooh.
What do you think about that?
I mean, I think we'll take his word for it that he's called tumultuous, however long he's been here.
Well, he's been in Iceland long enough to start trouble that gets 17 men killed. How about that?
That is true. We never do get any detail about the whys and wherefores there. The explanation for why Thorstein is even in Iceland is lost in the lacuna. Mm-hmm. We mentioned the Book of Settlements in the lacuna episode, though, and there we do get some information.
Yeah, I think this time we do need to reread that. It's kind of packed with information that could be useful.
Be my guest.
Well, it says, there was a man named Thorstein Svarfath, son of Rauð Cradle in Námadal. He married Hild, daughter of Thrain the Black Giant. Thorstein went to Iceland and settled Svarfaðsdal by the council of Helgi the Lean. Their children were Karl the Red, who dwelt at Karl's River, and Gudrun, whom Hafthor the Viking had for wife. Their children were Klauvi and Groa, whom Grís Merihard had for wife.
Okay, now, that offers detail, but what it does tell us is mostly different from the version this saga is working from.
Yeah.
It's tempting, for instance, it's tempting to use this as evidence that our saga's Thorstein has to be the son of the one in the settlements and the first part of the saga, since that one is the grandfather of Klauvi and Groa, and this one is their uncle.
But that's nonsense, because both Thorsteins are also the father of Karl the Red.
Yeah, and neither of them is the son of Rauð Cradle.
Yeah.
I said it was tempting. I didn't say it was a good idea.
Yeah, well, we learned that this Thorstein came to Iceland as part of Helgi the Lean's campaign to bring in new settlers.
Yeah, now this whole section of the settlements is more or less a list of people who have been recruited by Helgi.
Yeah, and that little section also names a few other people who are about to become important in this story, but not just yet. Right now, things settle down.
Mm-hmm.
We've clearly rejoined the saga at the end of a feud cycle, and everyone's just catching their breath. Now, some time passes, and Thorstein becomes actually friendly with Jotolf, the guy he was fighting against earlier, a guy who appears to have been the leading chieftain in this particular area.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they've come to respect one another. What's a mere 17 killings between neighbors?
Yeah.
It's water under the bridge.
It's just a whole lot of blood-stained water, but sure. So the two of them now form a consortium with a few other men. So we have Karl the Red and Bard the Grim, Thorkell Skekkjason, Nef Glita, and Ogmund Höskuldsson. And they start a series of games in the area where Karl the Red dominates strength contests. And the group of them also build a large fishing boat and use it to catch most of the fish in the nearby river. There are, of course, some complaints from other landowners in the area for all of this, and the complaints are brought to the local law speaker, who happens to also be Ogmund's dad, Höskuld.
Right, so these are a bunch of well-connected rich folks.
Oh, well, it's an Icelandic saga, so yes, yes. But somewhat surprisingly, Höskuld rules against his son and the gang, forcing them to turn over a quarter of the catch to each of the plaintiffs. But out of spite, Thorstein and his men deliver the catch without telling anyone, and ravens eat most of it and spoil the rest.
Ah, spiteful compliance. Mm-hmm. Always a favorite tactic.
Yeah, and they make sure it's obvious that it was spite, because they announce that they held to the letter of the law by delivering the catch.
Mm-hmm. Starting to suspect that Thorstein got that tumultuous nickname for a reason.
So, in essence, Thorstein and Jotolf are the big men around the area, but that doesn't mean that either of them is particularly popular.
Yeah, and you can see why. And now there's one more major figure to introduce. Jotolf has a kinsman named Grís, who was introduced at some point during the Lacuna. Mm-hmm. He's just returned to Iceland and decides to settle in the area. He takes land from Thorsten's side of the valley, though, and Thorsten only reluctantly agrees to allow it.
Yeah, which is a pretty clear indicator of how everyone really feels. Mm-hmm. Thorstein and Ljótolf may have buried the hatchet, but they know where to dig it up again if they need it.
Yeah, yeah. He doesn't like the idea of one of Ljótolf's kinsmen on his side of the valley.
Yeah.
But Grís...
essentially a neighbor to his farm.
Right, right. But Grís settles in, and he becomes friendly with others in the area, particularly another local named Oscar Redcloak. Oscar and his wife Thorild are expecting a child, but when she delivers, it turns out to be twins. We don't get a lot of twins in the sagas.
No.
These twins are going to be important later, but for now, we just need to know that their names are Thorleif and Olaf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's one thing that's kind of interesting about them. Their older sister makes a sort of prophecy about Thorleif when she sees a scratch on his arm, saying that it symbolizes the mark of a spear.
Right, but for now, they're babies. So hopefully he's got a while to go before that becomes relevant.
Yeah, but it does sound relevant. Mm-hmm. But for now, we're talking about Grís.
I know. So Grís has his new farm, but he's still a regular sailor as well, and it's not long before his next trip to Norway. He decides to spend the winter in Trondheim in Norway. He attempts to sail back the following spring, but he has a small problem with his ship that isn't really explained, so he has to put back in at Nidaros for a bit. And of course, people know Nidaros because it's been coming up a lot in the last few sagas. It's like one of the places where the Norwegian kings tend to hang out. He isn't there for long before he's approached by a woman leading two children behind her. And this woman says she has an odd request. She wants Grís to take these two kids to Iceland.
Why would they want to go there?
To meet their uncle, who lives near where you live. His name is Thorstein the Tumultuous.
Aha! John, we have an official plot point.
We do.
Yes, and Grís says, "Ah, and what is your name? And do you have any proof of what you say?"
"I am Thorarna."
And she gives him a rune stick, which is intricately carved with runes attributed to Thorstein.
Love it. Mm-hmm. A rune stick. Woo! And it's also kind of weird, but that's considered proof.
Yeah, it's clearly, there's an intended logic to it, but we're lacking details.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if the carving is distinct to a style, almost like handwriting.
And it's a hint that runic carving is going to be in a really an important part of this saga.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we'll be getting to that in a bit.
Yeah. So Grís says, "If I agree to this, you will think me rather greedy."
"Name the price."
400 ounces of silver. "And you must accompany the children, of course."
"No, I won't do that, but I will pay the price you demand."
She adds that the boy is named Klaufi, and the girl is named Sigrid.
And there should be some ominous music playing here, because one of these children is going to turn out to be a bad seed.
Mm-hmm. And there's a reason. The story takes a dark turn at this point, as Grís questions Thorarna, and she explains her history. She was kidnapped years ago by a Viking named Snakkul Jotsson, who kept her as a concubine and fathered these two children. Then he abandoned her and them in Norway.
This is brutal, brutal stuff, and it's not the last time we're going to see women treated horrifically in this saga.
It's true.
I mean, the narrative itself is as euphemistic as possible, avoiding any mention of assault or slavery. But as usual, the sagas tend to draw back from these kinds of details.
Yeah.
But that's clearly what's happening, as we said in the previous episode.
Absolutely. And a curious bit here is that there's definitely a chapter missing from Thorarna's story, because somehow she's managed to build enough of a life and economic stability for herself that she can afford to pay the ridiculous amount that Greece is asking.
Right, yeah. The younger kid, Klauvi, is only 2 years old, but clearly something's changed in Thorarna's life during that time.
Well, yeah, and this is where the deviation from the story in the settlements book is interesting, right? In that version, it's Thorsten's daughter, Gudrun, who has a son named Klauvi and a daughter named Groa.
Yeah.
And they're the product of an apparently acceptable relationship with Hafvor the Viking, right? Not an abduction.
Well, it's not terribly clear, but
well,
sure.
Had for a wife, right? The woman in the settlements book makes a lot more sense for this story than the one we're getting here.
Well, I mean, that version makes more sense for a lot of things, including Thorarna's desire to stay in Norway.
Absolutely. The change seems to be a way to create further tension and to link the earlier material to this later stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And as we said earlier, that also means that the settlement version kids are Thorsten's grandchildren, not his nephew and niece as they are here.
Yeah. Now, in this text, the man who's abused her is named Snækol Ljótsson.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some hints about his possible connection to Ljót the Pale that clearly Olafur Sigurðsson picked up on when composing or locating those missing leaves.
Right. And I can see that's possible. We can save that for just a bit. I want to be clear that the saga isn't centering on Thorarna's story here. Like, we find it interesting, but the saga doesn't particularly. The point is that Greece doesn't really want to take these kids. And that could be because of the added inconvenience of having small children on an open water voyage. But it could also be because this is going to mess with Thorsten. And he's not sure he wants to pay that particular piper with his very powerful neighbor.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Keep an eye on Greece's motives, because it's also possible that he's playing a deeper game here.
Right. Well, he's certainly not motivated by a desire to do a good turn for Thorarna.
No. He's charging her essentially a full weregild's worth of silver for each kid's transport. It's outrageous what he's charging to do this. And we have to assume that he meant it to be a deal breaker. Again, he doesn't seem to want to bring these kids with him, but he will for the right price.
Right. And once she agrees, he's kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that switch from wealthy Viking's wife to abandoned kidnapping victim doesn't really fit here. But it does explain why Greece is caught off guard by her sudden ability to pay.
Well, they're just two kids. I mean, how much trouble could they possibly cause?
Part 8. Klauvi the Mauler.
Well, that title kind of gives it away, don't you think?
Was it really a secret?
I mean, there's such a thing as suspense, but okay. So at first, the kids are no trouble at all, and neither is anything else. There's favorable wind all the way to Iceland. Smooth sailing all the way. No problems for Greece.
Uh-huh. And Greece, I assume, spends the time happily counting his 400 pieces of silver over and over.
Well, not exactly. He's got to use this time to figure out how to break the news of these kids to Thorstein. Fortunately, he's also got a plausible reason to go and see Thorstein right away anyways. You see, Thorstein's son Carl has also been out to sea, and Thorstein is eager for any news of where he might be and what he might be up to. So, as soon as he lands, Greece rides to Thorstein's place at Grund, but he's clearly got something on his mind. And after a while, Thorstein asks, "What's up?" And Greece says, "Well, it won't surprise me if you are not pleased with something I've done. You see, I've brought your sister's kids to Iceland with me."
"How is that possible? I doubt it, and I will not acknowledge any kinship with them without proof."
You see, and Greece actually does have proof, by the way.
Well, let's be honest here. What he's got is the rune stick that Thorarna had shown him. Proof is a strong word for that. It's a carved stick.
To you and I, it's just a carved stick. But, you know. Yeah. We hinted at this earlier. Runic carving is treated as an important communication tool in this half of the saga, and it's going to be kind of important in this episode.
Yeah. One of the motifs that recurs in this saga is this universal ability to recognize rune carving as the work of a specific person.
Right.
Now, I've never made an extended study of the variations in inscriptions, but from my limited knowledge, there are at least three ways to recognize a carving. Right.
Okay.
So one. Yes.
One has to be, this got to be obvious, right? It's common for runic inscriptions to say who made them. So
yeah.
If he carved it, his name's on it. That would be the clue.
Yeah, that was on the list. Yeah.
It's like, that's the most, every runestone's like, I did this. It was
right,
me.
Right. It's also possible that this is a specific stick that he gave his sister at some point in their past. Right? Hmm. Possibly a charm or even just a memento that he would then recognize.
I mean, it could be. For lack of a better term, handwriting. I mean, Thorstein mm-hmm. might have a distinctive style that is recognizable, or whoever wrote this might have a distinctive carving style that's recognizable.
Right. Dots his ease with a little heart, that kind of thing.
He's, oh, God. Sure.
and we can add a fourth possibility now that I'm thinking about it. Runic alphabets aren't consistent over time and place. Right. So conceivably, Thorstein could be using an unusual or archaic alphabet that would be distinctive.
Hmm.
But the saga does say he recognized the words, which suggests that the message itself is what's familiar to him.
Hey, do you remember when we used to cover one saga per episode, John?
Vaguely. So Thorstein acknowledges that the kids are probably related to him and asks Reese to bring them the next morning. And the next morning at breakfast, Thorstein has the children stand next to him at the table, and then he slaps them both really hard.
Yep. Yeah, so if anyone was wondering whether Thorstein is, or this version of Thorstein, is a nice guy, I mean, you know, no,
yeah,
not really.
He thinks he's testing something. The girl, Sigrith, who's 4, bursts into tears, which is reasonable and normal.
Mm-hmm.
The boy, Klaufey, is 2, and he remains silent and doesn't move.
Yeah, and I suspect I know what's going on here, but... Grease, who's watching all of this with his eyebrows raised, says, I think you've now openly acknowledged your kinship with these two children.
Right, you're not allowed to slap anybody else's kids.
Yeah.
Well, I intend this, to give you enough money to support the children. For the girl, I'll give you 20 hundreds of silver. For the boy, 40 hundred.
That is a lot of wealth.
It's a huge amount.
I mean, and Grease isn't really being given much of a choice here, is he?
Nope.
But he does ask, because he's curious, why make such a distinction between them?
Choose for yourself. Take charge of whichever one you wish. And Grease, who does seem to like the sound of jingling coins,
mm-hmm.
agrees to take Klaufey, who's been valued much higher. And Thorstein counts out the money and announces... that Grease is now responsible for Klaufey in word and deed.
In other words, when this kid turns out to be trouble, talk to Grease, don't talk to me.
Exactly. So, Andy, he counts out 40 hundreds of silver.
Mm-hmm.
As in, physically has that much. To be clear, this is saga storytelling. No one in Iceland is likely to have that kind of money sitting around in cash.
Ah, come on. That's walking around money. That's King Harald Fairhair money. It's nothing.
Yeah. No, you have to go through some pretty convoluted math and logic to try to actually like understand this, to convert ounces of saga age silver into purchasing power. But fortunately, Jim Ulvaag's Ancient Finances blog has done a lot of this work for us already. Based on a series of researched assumptions, Ulvaag ends up with an estimate of 1 ounce of silver being worth about $550 or 430 British pounds in modern money.
And Thorstein's paying 400 ounces of silver.
Mm-hmm.
Are we thinking long hundreds or regular? Just gotta ask.
Let's stay conservative and go with standard hundreds.
All right.
In terms of purchasing power, Thorstein is handing over $2.2 million worth of silver.
Million. That could easily be enough to pay for multiple ocean-going ships.
Yeah, I actually worked it out in sheep.
Ships or sheeps.
Whichever. Ulvaag's same post ends up at about 3 sheep for an ounce of silver, which seems high to me, but whatever. Even if we assume that he's lowballing it and double the price of sheep, we're still talking about 6,000 sheep here.
That's a full belly of mutton, that is.
Yeah, that's walking around mutton.
So Thorstein has bought himself freedom from responsibility for Clowvi's future behavior at the cost of a minor fleet, or more sheep than there probably are in the whole district.
You get the impression that this saga doesn't necessarily know a lot about the economics of medieval silver.
Or doesn't care. It doesn't matter.
Or doesn't care. True enough. Ignorance and apathy. Two powerful tools in a storyteller's hands.
Yes.
So now we can keep an eye on that money and see whether Thorsten's bought himself a bargain.
Yes, that's something worth doing. There's clearly something about this kid that Thorstein doesn't like the look of. Sigrid responded appropriately.
Right.
Suggesting that she carries something of Thorstein's family's blood in her veins. But I think that the slap of Clowvi suggests that there's something of Snækolljotsson in there. Something of that berserker Viking blood that Thorstein doesn't like the look of. And so he's willing to pay someone to take him off his hands and wash him of responsibility for.
I mean, that's tricky because this is a culture that prizes stoicism in men. Right? Mm-hmm. And so it'd be very easy to read this as a 2-year-old boy taking the blow stoically and that being a sign of his strength.
Yeah, but did he take it stoically or is there something in his eyes that Thorstein sees and doesn't like?
I mean, you know, you always accuse me of reading too much into these texts.
Yeah, well.
And now we're imagining things in the eyes of this 2-year-old.
Yeah, we are.
So I don't know.
Well, maybe he just doesn't like him. I don't know. But before he leaves, Gris tries one more time to get out of it or to kiss up to Thorstein, realizing that Thorstein doesn't like this kid. Either way, he says, I'll take him, but I intend to make him work very hard.
That's fine if you can manage it, which is slightly ominous.
Yeah, a little bit.
Now, at this point, there's a lull in the action. 8 years pass, during which time Carl the Red returns home and sails out again on his ship, which is, by the way, called the Icelander.
Yes, it is.
Not usual that we get the names of these ships.
No, and there's a very extensive description of the building of the ship, too.
Yep. It's a ship that we're meant to maybe recognize when we see it again.
Maybe.
Clowvi is now 10 years old, and things have been fairly quiet in the region for a while.
Yeah, and in that time, the games that were started have become an annual tradition. And this year, there's a young man named Thord the Wrestler who's been staying with Ljótolf. Now, we can't forget Ljótolf.
Mm-hmm.
And Thord is planning on showing up at these games.
Right, and he's got an odd way of making his mark on the event. He sends a man to Grease's farm with a rune stick insulting Clowvi and challenging him to a wrestling match.
So he's picking a fight with a 10-year-old out of the blue.
Yeah, well, it's a big 10-year-old. Clowfi's okay. Growing up quite large. But yeah, Clowfi's also a little uncertain about this. This is a grown man picking a fight with a tween. So he goes and asks his uncle Thorstein whether he should wrestle. And Thorstein says it's his call. Now, of course, Clowfi's not about to let an insult go by, so he decides to wrestle. And Thorstein agrees to travel with him to see the show.
Oh, and you forgot a bit there. Clowvi also borrowed an axe from Gris before they left the house.
Yes, right. And Gris threatened him before giving him the axe. We're not told what the threat was, but presumably it was that he shouldn't do anything violent with it.
Well, then, you know, maybe don't give him an axe.
Too late now. They arrive at Hof, and Thord is immediately looking to start their match. He refuses to fight anyone else. Gris and Thorstein both are there with Clowvi. But neither of them say anything, so the match begins right away. Right there in the hall. Right? They don't even go out into the yard for this.
Yeah.
Clowvi and Thord lock arms and struggle for a bit, but neither one gets the upper hand.
Yeah. And then in the middle of the match, a serving woman enters the building and laughs at them.
This is like a match between two little girls, with no one getting thrown. Why don't you kiss and make up? Ha ha ha!
Wow.
Wow, for a lot of reasons. I apologize to all the British women out there.
Yeah, what was that?
I don't know. Too much Monty Python, obviously.
Yes, clearly.
Yeah. But I did. I had to check the translation here because it's such an interesting line. And I should have trusted Heinemann. she literally tells them to kiss and stop fighting. They're hugging and swaying around so much that they might as well just kiss.
Right. It's not surprising, I guess. You know, shaming men for not being manly is it's pretty standard for the culture.
Men or 10-year-olds, apparently.
Was it Sorensen who said that all masculinity in the sagas is potentially vulnerable?
That sounds about right. The fragility of a manly reputation, the need to guard it constantly. I mean, that explains a lot of the conflicts in the in saga literature.
Yeah, well, it's effective against Klaufey for sure.
Yeah.
He hears this insult, turns red, and immediately lifts and throws Thor, who crashes to the ground with the wind knocked out of him.
Yeah.
Klaufey then leaps on top of him and thrashes him, while an old woman sitting nearby laughs and cheers him on.
Man, this is a tough room.
It really is.
They love that violence.
Now, when the match finally ends, Thor, who has been beaten to a pulp, has to be helped to a bench while the others head outside.
Yeah, and Gris says to Klaufey, I will give you a name for this, Klaufey, and call you Klaufey the Mauler, and you shall have these gloves for a naming gift.
But Klaufey looks at them and says, well, we haven't given Klaufey a voice yet. This is a big moment.
It's a big moment. And I got to remind you, he's 10, so you got to give him a voice he's going to grow into.
But yeah.
He shouldn't be all, you know, he's not a puppy.
Yeah.
One who loses his gloves cannot be happy, even if he gets another pair.
Of your most recent voice choices, I kind of like what you did there, John.
There you go.
I got to say.
And he spins around, and he goes back inside. He rushes over to where Thor is sitting, and then he buries the axe that he borrowed in Thor's head, killing him on the spot.
I mean, it's not a surprise, really.
No, we knew he brought the axe for a reason.
Yeah, and when he comes back outside, Thorstein asks him a familiar question about why his axe is bloody.
And Klaufey says,
I made sure that Thor will issue no more wrestling challenges.
Good line. Notable witticism candidate right there. Yeah.
And the saga doesn't actually say this, but we have to assume that Thorsten looks over at Gris with a nasty smile. Because Klaufey has just started his career of being a very expensive problem for Gris.
Yeah. This particular killing gets settled right there at the gathering with Gris paying out 600 pieces of silver. Triple the usual compensation.
Right. Now start keeping that tally because it's going to keep going up. For now, everyone goes home and there's quiet for a while. But not for long.
Nope.
Part 9. What does a Klaufey cost?
Now, at this point, a new group of people is introduced into the saga.
Right, and I know I've said this before, but it's not worth it to learn all their names, since a few of them aren't going to be around for very long. So let's keep it brief.
Easy to say. So there's a man named Hrani, who's under the protection of Hallvarth of Thorvaldsdal. Hrani is also the son of Katla the Elder, and Hrani lives next to the farm. Hrani lives next to the farm of Thrarin, who's a relative of Thorstein and Klaufey's. It's a lot of names. Are you keeping up? Hrani is a difficult neighbor who lets his sheep ruin Thrarin's pasture and overgrazes fields. So Thrarin sends word to Klaufey to ask him for help. To Klaufey, mind you.
Yeah, now a bit more time has passed here, but Klaufey's still pretty young to be getting called in for this kind of help. I mean, you have to assume that Thrarin's not looking for assistance in delicate negotiations with his neighbor.
Oh, that's a safe assumption. So Klaufey and Thrarin ride out into the fields. Where they find Hrani. And as usual, he's trespassing on Thrarin's lands with his flock. And Hrani is fully armed, but so is Klaufey. And he doesn't waste any time on preliminaries. Klaufey just races at him and attacks in a flurry so aggressively that Hrani can't even get his footing. And after a few minutes of fighting, Klaufey cuts Hrani down and just walks away, leaving his corpse in the field.
This kid's got talent.
He's got promise, yeah. Thrarin and Klaufey decide to ride straight back to Gris's farm to, as the saga says, reduce the money that had been given to Klaufey's keep. That's a great line.
It's excellent. You know, as much as this saga is giving us headaches, it does have its moments.
It really does. Yeah, there's some good quality stuff here. So this is right around where it all starts to go wrong, if it hadn't already. on the way to Grease's house, they see a relative of Hoskold, the law expert, a man named Orne, and he's riding on one of Grease's horses. Clawvy just rides up to Orne and kills him without a word.
For no reason.
No reason that I can tell, unless it's to annoy Grease.
Yeah, that isn't something the saga's really mentioned, but yes, as we'll see, Clawvy and Grease aren't huge fans of one another.
Yeah.
Grease doesn't think of himself as a foster father to Clawvy so much as a man who's got a servant he's being paid to keep in the house.
Yeah, exactly. And like you said, he's going to work him hard, and he does his best to do that. So Grease took in Clawvy as a way to ingratiate himself with Thorstein, I think. But if that claim to make him work has been followed, he's been treating this kid almost like a slave. And Clawvy is now old enough and big enough to do something with his resentment.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure I agree with the ingratiating himself part. He got stuck with this kid. And now Clawvy moved into just flat out murdering people as a way of acting out. Clawvy's showing signs of being a vicious killer of the kind we haven't seen since, I think, really Thorgeir in False Brother Saga.
Yeah, that might be true. And we got to keep an eye on this guy. But for now, Clawvy arrives home covered in blood and refuses to answer Grease's questions until after he's had something to eat. But as he's finishing his meal, 12 men ride up to the farm. They're led by Clawvy's uncle Thorstein the Tumultuous and the chieftain Halvarth from Thorvaldsdal. And they've arrived to take up a case for compensation for the death of Hrani. And with Thorstein looking on, Grease has to pay out 1,200 ounces of silver for Hrani's death.
That didn't take long.
No. And I really like the idea that Clawvy's visible over Grease's shoulder, just sitting at the table, wiping his mouth, still covered in blood, while all this goes on at the door.
Now, 1,200 is a big chunk out of the money from Thorstein.
Yes, it is.
It's also a sign this is perceived as a particularly bad killing.
Yeah.
Hrani was on the wrong property, sure, but that could easily be called a mistake.
Yeah, and there are ways to prosecute that, and it doesn't involve killing the guy.
Right. And he was killed while watching over his flock, which a lot of laws protect farmers working in the field, and this is a version of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a great look, and it costs extra.
Yeah, and as those men are counting out the money, suddenly another group, led by Hoskold the law expert, arrives to demand compensation for the death of Orne, the guy that was killed for no reason. And Grease has to pay out another 600 in silver.
I mean, this is a comic set piece.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. It also puts us over the halfway mark on the money Grease was given for Clawvy's upbringing, by the way.
I mean, that's starting to look like a shrewd investment on Thorstein's part, right? This kid has got to be, what, like 13 years old, something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
And this is going to be a real turning point for Clawvy, who now starts to act even worse than before.
I'm sorry, worse.
Yeah.
Than murder.
Hey, it's a paraphrase from the saga. Take it up with the narrative. That's what they say.
Now, obviously, Grease is getting increasingly worried about what he's taken on here. But he's still determined to get some work out of Clawvy. So he sends Clawvy and Clawvy's friend Hudskegi fishing, which I realize as I say it, it sounds like he's being given a day off. This is, real fishing, work fishing.
Yeah.
Hauling nets fishing, not like sitting on the bank with a reel and a beer.
Yeah, this isn't Opie and Andy, strolling along the lake. This is the real deal.
Exactly. But even that hard work doesn't keep Clawvy out of trouble because he meets a man named Bjorn down at the river.
Yeah, and Bjorn is a farmhand who works for Rolf Shiny Nose, who lives nearby and who is one of the major supporters of Thorstein and Jotolf.
Can I just say I'm very pleased to have a man named Shiny Nose in this saga?
Well, me too, because in high school, I had a very shiny nose.
Did you?
Yeah, it was a pretty bit of a problem. But Bjorn the farmhand and Clawvy start arguing right away over who's going to fish where. Remember, there's this issue of control over who can do what where.
Right. Well, we've already seen arguments over local fishing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The problem is that Bjorn wants to fish on the river, And Clawfy wants the entire river to himself.
Yeah, well, we said he's in a mood, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, listeners, you can see where this is going.
Mm-hmm.
It's not long before Bjorn and Clawfy come to blows, and it doesn't take long before Clawfy kills Bjorn. And then he goes home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how much he fished that day.
Not much.
And once again, a neighbor comes around to complain, and this time it's Rolf Shiny Nose. And Grease has to pay out yet another 600 silver for Bjorn's death. So that's four men dead, and Clawfy still a tween.
Yep. Well, he turns out to be more of a fisher of men, if I may paraphrase the Gospels.
All right.
So is Bjorn just another guy caught up in the path of Clawfy's efforts to bankrupt his foster father?
Well, I mean, that was a pretty transparent segue, so I'm guessing your answer is no.
Yeah, it is. Thanks for asking. Yes, Bjorn just happens to come along on this day, right? There's no past between the two of them. But Clawfy is aware that he's being treated like a lowborn man, right? Even as a servant or a slave by Grease, right?
I think so, yes. It's a big part of why he's acting out, although one could argue that it's just his nature, which was exposed in the slap, you know?
Sure.
But I think, you know, we'll see a bit later that Clawfy's very aware of how Grease treats other people who visit his home. And Clawfy's being treated as a servant by a man who treats other people pretty well, regardless of their rank. It's clearly a big part of what's eating him, I think. But we have to read between the lines to pull that out.
Absolutely. But so my point is that Bjorn shows up at the same time and place as Clawfy, doing the same menial but hard work of hauling in fishing nets and so on.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, work that's appropriate to Bjorn's status as a laboring farmhand.
Yes.
Right? It's a reminder of the status or lack of status that Clawfy holds in Grease's house.
Yeah, it does make sense. But it's not like Clawfy really needs an excuse to be unpleasant or to kill someone.
Oh, I know.
He loves that kind of thing.
Yeah. No. What was it? I made the comparison to Thorgir earlier. What was it that Thorgir said in Fossbrogja after he cut that field laborer's head off? I couldn't help it. He stood so well poised for the blow.
Yes, I think the killing of Orn right there, right?
Yeah, right. Same concept. You know, Clawfy's a man who sees the entire world as well poised for the blow.
Yeah.
It's just a nice bit of understated narrative parallelism to think of Bjorn's presence as provoking Clawfy even more than life is already provoking him.
Yeah, and again, if he is the blood of Snækol, the son of Ljot the Viking, who Thorstein killed in the earlier parts of this series, then it makes sense. He's got that kind of like rough Viking violent blood in him, and Thorstein spotted it and wisely put him off on Grease. All right, you ready to move on? Let's go.
Part 10. Where in the world is Carl the Red?
That's that. Okay. All right. I'll accept it. So it's no secret that Clawfy has become a bit of a problem for Grease.
Well, that'll teach him to get involved in the affairs of others.
True, but I think that Grease was doing his best to, this is my opinion now, ingratiate himself with the leadership of Svarfaðardal. He couldn't have realized at the time what a terrible burden Clawfy would become.
Well, if he'd listened to that story of Clawfy's parentage, he might have at least had a hint.
Maybe.
The sagas are very invested in that notion that the father's character carries over to the son. Snækol is no Ward Cleaver, Andy.
No, probably not. That's not surprising if we follow the suggestion that Snækol Ljótsson is the son of Ljót the Pale.
Mm-hmm. If that's the case, then the original Thorstein's quest for glory and fame, it's really coming back to haunt subsequent generations of this family.
Mm-hmm.
Because now, right, descendants of both sides are clashing, and Thorstein Svarvath has to contend with this unruly child of what undoubtedly was a very unpleasant Viking.
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning that if Clawfy is indeed the grandson of Ljót the Pale, then he's also half Swedish with a genetic predisposition to being a berserker. And that does actually fit into Frederick Heinemann's theory about the saga's negative portrayal of the Swedes, which we were talking about in previous episodes. If much of the trouble of this part of the saga comes from Klavi and his cousin Carl the Red, he argues we need to look no further than their lineage. And here I'll share a quote for you from his article. We must remember that Carl Innrauði is the son of a man with a Norwegian father and a Swedish mother. Klavi, abandoned by first his father and then by his mother, is the son of a woman with a Norwegian father and a Swedish mother, and of a man who is the son of a presumably Swedish Viking, Ljótr Innbleiki. In addition, Klavi's father's uncle, Moldi, was a Swedish berserk. The saga seems to throw up its hands at this point, asking the reader what can be expected from such bloodlines.
I mean, he's not wrong about the bloodlines.
Well, I sense a butt coming.
Sorry, I'll keep it in my chair.
Oh, please don't.
Yes, you're right, that I'm not wholly comfortable with Heinemann's theory that this saga, that it's really building itself around and so invested in this anti-Swedish agenda.
Yeah.
Is there a general undercutting of Swedes in the saga? Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm willing to go that far. It's part of a long, long history of Norwegian-Swedish relations to do that kind of thing. And in fact, you can even find modern videos on YouTube of people interviewing Norwegians or Swedes about how they feel about each other, which I thought was is kind of funny. But we do see this kind of thing throughout the sagas, where Swedes tend to be almost caricatures of unruly, violent thugs.
Okay, but is there, as Heinemann's suggesting, a broad political effort here to highlight the negative, immoral, and dangerous nature of Swedish blood in order to reveal the higher quality of the Norwegian character?
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that, at least as an overt agenda by the saga author. For me, Klavi and Carl the Red, to a lesser extent, are stock agents of chaos. They help to create the kind of regional tension and feuding that drives all sagas. The Swedish blood flowing through their veins doesn't seem central to the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, this is true, I think. But here's my but.
Oh, dear.
Well, hear me out, because I think we both actually agree on this. The fact that both of these characters happen to have Swedish blood, that Klavi in particular is so bad, becomes easier to understand for the Icelandic and Norwegian audience if he's cast in the mold of a Swede. And it's that inherent bias, that this negative portrayal of the Swedes is so ingrained into the culture that it isn't really worth highlighting much in the story itself. Well, that's then worth noting for what it reveals about Icelandic attitudes at the time that this story was written. But again, it's not surprising. We do see this negative cultural attitude throughout the sagas.
I mean, it's true. The literature preserves the biases of the cultural moment, as all literature does.
Yeah, and it's not just directed at the Swedes in the sagas, though we don't see them as often. Finns and Finland, usually cast as wild, mystical, and savage.
Right. I mean, that's not surprising, as you said, but it is worth noting for a variety of reasons. One reason is that it helps us to understand the evolution of a cultural bias, right, of prejudices.
Which, I mean, Heinemann does, right? But the problem, if we can shift back to Heinemann, is that his essay is poorly titled as Svarfdala Saga, Norwegians versus Swedes.
Mm-hmm.
He sets it up that way, sure, but I don't really think that's the point of his essay, having read it all the way through, or the strength of it, anyway.
Yeah, by the middle of the article, he's not really invested in that issue anymore.
No. He merely points out that the negative attitude the saga has towards the Swedes, which is true, and it's worth acknowledging, as we just discussed. But the bulk of the essay is about the saga author's attitude toward revenge and violence and the medieval Icelandic understanding of honor. And that, I think, is what he does well in the article. It's something I think we should come back to once the listeners get a real sense of the craziness that Klavi and Carl the Red introduce into Svarfaðardal.
Yeah, and speaking of which...
Yeah.
Gris took a gamble when he decided to foster Klavi for Thorsten. So far, that gamble hasn't paid off.
No. In fact, it's been quite expensive for Gris. Mm-hmm. I did a bit of Andy math here, and I feel...
Oh, boy. Strap in, everybody. We're getting some Andy math.
I want to remind you, I've been pretty good lately.
You've looked slightly less foolish, yes.
Hey, thank you.
Slightly.
All right. Well, let's run down the receipt, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
So, first, Grise made the mistake of agreeing to ferry Klauvi and his sister over to Iceland from Norway. That was a net gain for him. He was paid 400 ounces of silver.
Yeah, and it's a net gain because we're assuming that the space he gave over to Klauvi and Sigrid couldn't have been better filled with something worth more than 400 ounces of silver.
Well, that's very interesting. Yeah, I'm assuming he overcharged Thorstein's sister for the service by a lot. He's that kind of guy. So he's currently 400 ounces of silver up for the favor, right? Now, as we said earlier, Thorstein offers him 4,000 ounces of silver to foster Klauvi, which Grise readily takes.
Right now, some of that cost is meant to pay for the trouble of keeping him. Right, things like food and clothes and that
kind of thing. And man prices.
Man prices, sure.
There's occasional wear guild you can expect when fostering someone like this. Because, honestly, Thorstein, I think, knows that in the end, 4,000 ounces of silver is going to be nothing compared to the fines and penalties that Klauvi could rack up if he's anything like his, dare I say, Swedish lineage suggests he might.
You are really not winning points with the nation of Sweden tonight.
Socially awkward berserks. The real Stockholm Syndrome.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Grise is 4,400 ounces of silver up.
Yeah.
And he's got a strong young man to work on his farm.
Yeah. But by the age of 10, Klauvi starts costing his foster father. He kills Thor the Wrestler. That's 600 ounces of silver. Not longer after that, he kills Hrani. That one costs Grise 1,200 ounces of silver, and then another 600 for the random guy, Orn, that he killed on his way home. And then finally he killed Bjorn, who costs another 600 ounces of silver.
You know, I think you're fortunate. These are all multiples of six.
I agree. So that's 3 times 6, which is 1,800, plus the 1,200 for Hrani.
Mm-hmm.
And that all adds up to, 3,000 ounces of silver paid out for all the killing so far. And Klauvi is just a teenager. So let's go back. Grise started with 4,400 ounces of silver, and he's already down to just 1,400. And Klauvi's just a young teenager.
Yeah, it's not looking like a great deal for Grise at this point.
Not at all. And now he's looking for a break. In the summer, after the slaying of Bjorn on the river, Grise decides that he'd like to travel abroad for a while, maybe get away.
Yeah.
And as he's preparing, Klauvi approaches to ask if maybe he can tag along.
Yeah, and I'm sure this is the last thing Grise wants to hear.
For sure.
Remember that Grise took Klauvi on with the intention of working him hard, getting closer to Thorstein. He's hoping that Klauvi can manage the farm while he's overseas.
Which is why Grise decides to go to Thorstein the Tumultuous to ask for a bit of advice on how to get Klauvi to stay home and take care of the farm.
Yeah, but Thorstein sees another opportunity for everyone here.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I suggest you take him along. Klauvi has many kinsmen there in the east. I think it unlikely that he'll be eager to return here to Iceland.
And this... Well, this is music to Grise's ears.
I mean, it would kind of solve the problem for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, Thorstein never had any interest in having his niece or nephew with him in Iceland, which is why he was willing to pay so much to foster them off.
Right. I mean, their mother didn't really want them either.
No.
She, I believe the phrase is, yeeted them onto Grise's ship and ran off as fast as she could.
Yeeted. Yes. Yeeted indeed. And while Thorstein couldn't care less about his nephew's fate, he does worry about his own son, Karl the Red. And so, once again, he asks Grise to look into what might have happened to him while traveling around in Norway.
That's right. Karl the Red sailed off back when Klauvi was fighting Thor the Wrestler.
And he hasn't been heard from since.
Well, before you know it, Grise and Klauvi set sail. They spend a winter in Trondheim, but there's nothing really reported about their time there, so we're just going to move right on.
Yeah.
When summer comes, they prepare to sail home.
Wait a minute. Where's Klauvi? Didn't Thorstein just say he'd fall in love with the East and bond with his kinsmen and decide to never come back to Iceland?
He did say that, yes. But no. Klaufey is on the ship heading for Iceland and already arguing with Greece about how to sail and what route to take.
Almost as if the author of the saga once again introduced us to a potentially interesting episode and then forgot all about it.
It is almost as if that is the case, yes. But while he may have forgotten to include Klaufey's adventures in Norway, he didn't forget about the missing Carl the Red.
Well, that's good.
Because as they sail south along the shore, they spot something suspicious.
Ooh.
Two ships laying at anchor off a little island. And no one, as far as they can tell, is aboard either ship.
Well, I mean, it's the Viking Age, John. Is it really that odd to see two ships parked near an island?
Well, with no one on board and no one nearby. Also, I think friends of ours, people who actually, you know, have sailed on these ships, might object to the term parked.
Maybe.
I feel like that's not a term that would be used for people actually sailing a long ship.
Grounded, pulled in.
At anchor, perhaps?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a little bit odd, but more to the point, the saga treats this as odd.
Fair enough. If the saga says it's odd, then it's odd.
So they board one of the ships and have a look around. And sure enough, Klaufey spots some rune carvings on the ship.
What?
Presumably, I don't know, on the mast or on the rail or something.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Klaufey can't read them.
Yeah, but it's been established that Greece can read runes, as we saw in his encounter with Klaufey's mother.
Right, except when Klaufey asks him to read the runes, Greece shrugs and says, he doesn't know.
Yeah, yeah.
But Klaufey insists and forces Greece to read the runes. And those runes say, Carl commanded this ship when these runes were carved.
Now, I know we said this earlier, but the use of runes in this text, at least the second part of this text, is really fascinating. Like,
yeah, we don't see a lot of this in the saga.
It's a nice touch and one we don't think of too often, but it's a very useful tool for writing a story, having written communication available for storytelling purposes.
Yeah, it adds a new element.
It does. Yeah. So what do you make of this, John?
Make of what, the runes?
No, I mean, we kind of talked a little bit about the runes, although there's so much more to say. But I'm curious more about what you think about Greece not wanting to read the runes.
Oh.
Because it's implied here that he looked at the runes, he knows what they say, and if that's true, why does Klaufey have to force him to read the runes?
I mean, I'm going to preface this by saying that we've established already nothing in Svarfdala's saga is consistent and very little makes coherent sense.
I see. So you think there's nothing really more going on here?
Maybe. Like what?
Well, like Greece trying to undercut Thorstein the Tumultuous. Because maybe he's trying to ensure that Carl the Red stays gone.
That's certainly possible, I guess. Greece, remember, is a kinsman of Jotolf, right? Thorstein's one-time rival.
Right, yeah. But as we work our way through the post-Lacuna version of the saga, I think we need to pay close attention to characters and their hidden motivations.
Mm-hmm.
So far, it's seemed like Greece is a greedy opportunist who positions himself closest to the source of power. But there is a chance that there's more to Greece than we or even Thorstein or anyone else has assumed up to this point.
So you're suggesting that Greece is some kind of saboteur?
I am. And I'm not the first to suggest such a thing. Greece's reluctance to read the runes suggests to me that he secretly hopes that Carl never returns to Iceland. And maybe, just maybe, he knows exactly where Carl is and what happened to him. And like I said, I'm not the first to suggest this. In her master's thesis on Svarfdala saga, one of the few works of scholarship out there on this saga, Linda Sexton has a lot to say about Greece, several chapters worth. And I believe she calls him an agent provocateur at one point.
I see. So Greece moving in next door to Thorstein, fostering his nephew, all that wasn't really about kissing up to Thorstein. It's about getting closer for some more nefarious purpose.
Possibly, yes.
It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would expect no less from someone who carries the noble name of Sexton, but it's very interesting.
Very interesting indeed. But I think we're going to save the rest of this conversation for the next time.
Well, you're going to tease the audience with a bombshell like that and walk away?
Yes. Yes, I am.
And what about Carl the Red, Andy?
Well, his ship is there. It's suspiciously empty. I think it's quite possible that the poor fellow is in need of some rescuing.
A cliffhanger. We're doing a cliffhanger.
That's right, a cliffhanger.
Is this the moment that Clawfy, a violent and ruthless murderer, takes a turn to become the hero of the saga?
And what happened to Carl the Red?
Find out next time on Saga Thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But in the meantime, please let us know what you think of Svartdal Saga Mark II. Is Thorsten Tumultuous the same Thorsten from part one of this story?
I think John and I are divided on that one. But is Clawfy really as bad as we're making him out to be?
Yes. That's an easy question.
What do you expect from the rest of the story? And what do you wish we'd provided more detail about?
Good Lord, we're averaging under 4 chapters an episode here. Don't ask for more detail, please. But in the unfortunate case that someone does have questions, how would they go about asking them?
Well, if you want to make your question part of the ongoing conversation between episodes, we've got the unofficial official Discord server for Saga Thing.
It's actually pretty official over there, honestly.
Yeah, it is.
And we're talking about everything from Icelandic beer quality to the Nazis' obsession with Disney movies and The Hobbit to an evolving Saga Thing-inspired hex crawl project. Yes. It's pretty great. Yeah.
Otherwise, there's all the usual places. We're on Facebook and X and Instagram and Blue Sky, where we are Saga Thing Podcast or Saga Thing Pod. You figure it out which one. And we're also on Gmail, where we are sagathingpodcast@gmail.com.
And if none of that works, try sending it to us along with 4,000 ounces of silver.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be surprised how effectively that'll get our attention.
Oh. We might even come to your house. All right. We are going to be back soon with the story of Carl the Red's abandoned ship and the ongoing career of Clawfy the Mauler. Until then, thanks for listening.
Bye for now.
Look at us. Look at us. We are right in it.
Okay. It's just this throwaway thing that they mentioned, that this is why he has a plausible reason to go visit Thorsten's farm right away.
Okay. So intricately written, this saga. Hmm.
It is, actually. Too bad it's, also a train wreck.
Seems like it's missing some pieces.
I mean, bits and pieces here and there.